Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by First Republic Bank. The world is changing, and your needs are evolving. As your focus turns to what matters most to you and your community, First Republic remains committed to offering personalized financial solutions that fit your needs. From day one, you'll be connected with a dedicated banker who will serve as your primary point of contact throughout your relationship with the bank. They'll be there to listen to you, understand your values, and meet you on your financial journey. Your banker can offer solutions that support your goals at any stage, from setting up a personal checking account to refinancing household debt to buying a first home. As your needs evolve, you can call or email your banker at any time for the support you need. Because First Republic believes what matters to you matters most. Learn more at firstrepublic.com. That's firstrepublic.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
You're listening to...
Whoa!
You're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. I'm Marvin Yeh.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we're here today to talk about our October 2020 book club pick, Confessions by Kanae Minato, translated by Steven Snyder. And whew, Rira, you picked a doozy for Spooky Month 2020.
It really was the perfect read for Spooky Month, in my opinion.
Yeah. This episode should be released on Election Day 2020. How are you feeling, Rira, as we enter this potentially new era?
I've just been trying not to think about it. I submitted my ballot a couple of days ago, and I'm like, well, it feels kind of hopeless, but you know, I don't want to think about it. I don't want like, when the results come out, I'm still skeptical on how much can change, how much damage control we can do.
Yeah. Oh, well, at least we can still escape to our books. As a resident alien from Canada, I'm counting on all you people to pull through for us.
Oh, that's right. You can't vote because... No. Oh, wow. I voted for the first time when I moved to California because I didn't become naturalized until I was like 21, 20.
Okay. Which election was that?
This is only like my second election because because the last election, the first, very first one I voted for was Trump versus Clinton.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wow, I was so disappointed by the results.
I know.
It was my first election, my first vote, and I was like, wow, I feel like my vote didn't count, but that's democracy for you, right?
I mean, it did count. It just didn't count enough.
Yeah, I know.
Because of the Electoral College or some bullshit.
You know, like, our international listeners are going to just be so confused.
No, I think they understand also what's at stake here. I mean, everyone knows the situation that our country is in. And yeah, so those of you listening in the future, how is it over there? I hope it's not as bleak as it is now. But quick reminder that we're going to be talking about the whole of Confessions by Kanae Minato. So that includes spoilers. And since this book is kind of like a crime thriller, you definitely don't want to get spoiled before you get into it. So make sure you read the book before coming back and listening to our discussion.
Yeah, I would put this in the same category as Never Let Me Go. Just go into it as cold as possible.
Yeah.
And then come back and listen to us.
And it's a pretty quick read. It's only about 235 pages. For a novel, it's relatively short. So you can probably knock it out in a day or two and come back.
Okay, so we're going to move on to our discussion.
Yeah.
Marvin, what have you heard about this book before? Because it, you know, it was an international bestseller. You know, it was extremely popular in Japan. It sold millions of copies. And there's a movie based on this book as well. So have you heard about this book before going in?
I actually haven't. So this was my first time exposed to this, I guess you can call it source material. I actually didn't know there was a film.
Oh, yeah. It's directed by Tetsuya Nakashima, who is a pretty well-known director. And it debuted at the Toronto International Film Festival back in 2010.
Okay.
And it got a lot of critical acclaim. So I have not watched the movie yet, but I am very interested in how they adapted it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a form of story that is somewhat familiar in Asian media tropes, which is like the revenge story, right? Like we've seen this before in like Korean cinema, a lot of Japanese like films, anime, manga, light novels also feature stories that like kind of focus on revenge, right? Like the wrong party getting their justice. This is probably one of the darker ones of these that I've read.
So a little bit about the author, Kanae Minato. She started writing in her 30s, and Confessions is her debut novel. It came out in 2009, I believe, 2008. So it came out a long time ago in Japan, and it only got translated in like 2010. And, you know, she's won like a couple of like very prolific Japanese crime awards. And she was a home economics teacher and a housewife. So actually, after I finished Confessions, I bought the only other English translated book of hers, which is Penance. And that also has to do with revenge and children and very similar themes. I don't know if all her other books are the same way, though.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't know, so... If anyone has read any of her other untranslated works, please let us know. But
yeah, she's written a lot. There are over like 12 novels that she's written so far.
So what are your overall impressions of Confessions, Rira?
I was so surprised by the format of this book. I did not expect it to be first person. The first chapter, like, was definitely the most impactful for me. I think the first chapter could easily be a standalone short story.
Yeah, I mean, it is in a nutshell like a self-contained revenge story in itself, right? And I do agree, it's written in a really interesting way, which is like it's just a monologue given by the teacher, the main character, Yuko Moriguchi. To her class. And it was interesting that the author didn't write the responses from the students, but you can still kind of feel like what they're saying, right?
Yeah, I actually heard that Kanae Minato, like she used to be an aspiring screenwriter. So after hearing that little bit of detail, I was like, wow, that makes sense. Because a lot of her writing is cinematic. With like the milk cartons, I was just like, I can picture that in my head. It's like everything is so visual, even though everything is being told through a monologue and you don't see the students, you don't really hear their responses. It's it's just the teacher talking. And I was really surprised by like how much tension was present and how like meandering her resignation speech was, but how I could feel the dread building up.
Yeah. On that note, speaking of milk cartons, what did you think about the whole milk subplot? Like this government program to get kids to drink milk. I wonder if that's a real thing.
I think it's a real thing. Because I know that Korea had something similar. So I can only imagine that Japan did that as well. I think the government is very, in terms of like East Asian governments, they implement a lot of health programs. And a lot of the times they're mandatory. So teachers really don't have much control
on
that kind of stuff. Man, but that sucks. That sucks. If you're lactose intolerant and you're forced to drink that, like, that fucking sucks.
I grew up drinking milk as a kid, and I never really developed any real strong lactose intolerance. I mean, I have what I think is probably average for most people, which is like I get kind of gassy, but like I've never experienced like lactose induced pain. I've always wondered if like the tolerance is something that you gain by like drinking milk as a kid or not. What were your experiences with milk specifically?
I had absolutely no problems with it. I know like I it's a joke that comes up a lot among like Asian conversation and Asian American media on how like our bodies reject white people food and we reject like dairy products because most Western food has a dairy product in it. But I've never had any trouble with milk.
Yeah. I've always been curious because I don't have personal experiences with that kind of like those types of problems. Although I do wonder, maybe our rejection of white people food is just the fact that white people food doesn't taste good.
I mean, if you're lactose intolerant, I don't think it's about taste. I think it's just about genetics. Yeah.
But is that
a
genetic thing?
A lot of Asian people are lactose intolerant. So I do wonder like what the percentage is in terms of like what are the chances that you would have it?
Yeah, because the sample size of this Books and Boba podcast is zero. None of us have it. So
I'm so grateful because I love dairy. Yeah. And Japanese milk tastes so good. Japanese ice cream, Japanese milk. I don't know what's in it. Probably like extra hormones, but it is so, so good.
Do you watch Great British Bake Off?
I know I'm going on a tangent. But now it's just Paul Hollywood.
Well, they had a Japanese week challenge last week.
Oh, no. And it was terrible. Oh, no.
It was the worst.
No, British people cooking, British people baking Japanese desserts. Oh, man, that sounds wrong.
They didn't even like the first challenge was make a meat bun. And everyone made like a Chinese style meat bun. It was terrible. It was horrible.
Oh, my God.
You had like a ton of people talking shit about matcha. It was just go online.
Oh, my God. Every season, someone makes matcha. And is it Paul Hollywood? It's someone. Maybe it's Mary Berry. But there's always someone who hates matcha. And a contestant makes a matcha dessert. And they're like, oh, this wasn't good because it was matcha. And I'm like, that's racist.
Yeah, it was just an episode full of just microaggressions. There's the showstopper challenge was make a kawaii cake, which what the fuck is that? And also they pronounce it kawaii, which means scary in Japanese. So yeah, it's a total mess. Just go online, search GBBO Japanese Week, and just bask in the hate. It's bad.
I'm just saying, it's called the British Bake Off, but most of the desserts they make are not British.
Well, you know.
Colonization, that's how it works, right? And also just all the good desserts were made by French people.
Yeah.
Anyway, we digress.
Yeah.
We're going to go back to, I guess, like the first chapter. It was very impactful. Like, honestly, like, I was not expecting the milk twist at the end.
Figured that out, like, halfway through when she started talking about, like,
AIDS.
When she started talking about AIDS, like they started, she started leaving like breadcrumbs. But about the time when she's talking about how like she was going to like how she wasn't going to the police about the murder, like in my head, I was like, okay, this is like a revenge story. So how is she going to take revenge? Aha, she's probably going to give them AIDS. I think I figured that out.
When,
three-fourths
she
of the way
mentioned
through.
AIDS, that was when I was like, I was just like, okay, like it has to be related. Like, there's no way she's going on the spiel about how her students are being grossed out by someone who has AIDS, but they're not grossed out by murder.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah. I mean, that first chapter to me was the most striking. It's probably out of all the chapters, the one that I thought was written the best. Because like you said, it was kind of a self-contained revenge story. It was in ways really thrilling, and like you had a clear protagonist and you had a clear like pair of antagonists, and the way that she pretty much like does the mic drop to like say boom, you're screwed.
Oh yeah, it definitely was a mic drop moment.
Yeah, it was kind of satisfying as a revenge story, right? Because you know, in revenge stories, you want to see justice for the wrong party. And
justice, though?
I mean, that's up to the reader after you learn more. Like, I still think it is, in a way. I mean, one of the things you learn throughout, like, from the rest of, like, the other six chapters is, like, nobody really in this book is innocent. Everyone is kind of guilty of something. Or like not entirely sympathetic, right? I think the only person that's entirely innocent was Manami, the little girl that gets murdered.
Yeah, even Mizuki, who is the who is like the class president, who gets murdered later on. You find out that she's also not completely right in the head, so you don't feel as bad about the murder. As like the four-year-old who gets murdered, obviously.
I mean, I think you still feel a little bad. I think she is...
I'm just saying that you don't feel as bad.
I mean, I feel like after Manami, Mizuki, the class president, is probably the person you probably could feel justified in feeling sympathetic for, because, I mean, she becomes obsessed with like the lunacy murders, right? And kind of like is looking into it. But not to the point of like, I don't think she was really trying to copycat.
No, I don't think so.
I think she's just really like interested in, and I think that's natural for people to be interested in like things that are abnormal, right? Whenever there is a mass killing in the States, like people get really into like trying to figure out why or how or what happened, right? I think she, like, to me, her character is collateral damage from the teachers, from Moriguchi's revenge plot, because she gets inadvertently pulled into the bullying. And like, we got to talk about the Werther, the replacement teacher Werther, who like kind of,
oh god, what
drives
tool.
Her also, like, she the reason she starts getting like murderous ideations is because he's like pissing her off to no end, right? And I think being around people who have done, like, actually put into action like murderous intent, I think that affects you, right? That affects your own moral judgment, like saying, okay, if everyone around me is doing this kind of stuff, I can do it too. I feel like that's where her character was headed before she, you know, gets
killed
herself.
Well, there was also like, didn't she believe that she had split personality, and or like she and the lunacy girl were like the same person? Because that's what I thought it was. Like, she believed that she actually did commit the lunacy murders, and for some reason, like, she is like, there was something like very, I remember reading it and thinking, okay, like,
yeah, but definitely that was from Shuya's perspective, though. I don't think you ever got that from her own perspective chapter. I don't know.
Yeah, but wasn't that the twist, though? Like, when you're reading Shuya's perspective and you find out that she is, you know, not so right in the head and not so much of a martyr, which is the name of her chapter. You know, she's not completely a model moral person.
I guess, but at the same time, I also don't trust Shuya's narrative neither.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, this book is called Confessions because you're literally getting confessions from each important character. And, you know, I think there is an attempt to make Naoki and Shuya, the two middle school murderers, to be at least, like, I did not find them to be sympathetic characters, but it was like an attempt to show their perspective and to have them kind of justify their own actions, even though
I think even
the
then,
path
I mean,
to the path to murder was not justified.
But I think even then, like, both of those stories are written in similar ways, which is, yeah, you're reading their justifications of why they committed murder, and they give all these reasons, but at the end, those reasons aren't, like, to me at least, not enough to justify it, right? Like, those reasons added up, like, Naoki feeling inferior to Shuya, feeling like he deserves more recognition for his efforts. Like, those by themselves aren't enough to justify him, like, intentionally killing a 4-year-old girl when he had the opportunity to not to, you know? And I think, like, with the revenge story, there's two ways she could have gone about it, right? One is to portray either of the boys as someone who was, like, overwhelmed by guilt and feeling like they need to atone and, like, living their life, kind of like how they portrayed the husband of Moriguchi, who, like, decides to spend the rest of his life making up for his mistakes. But the way that she wrote both of these boys' characters, like, I feel like, I mean, and it's a complicated emotion, right? But, like, yeah, they deserved, like, you kind of feel like they deserved what they had coming, like, what their punishment, right? Like, even though that punishment involves, like, third party, like, involves other people getting hurt, which is, like, I don't know, like, there is no clean revenge, like,
no,
in
definitely
the world.
there is no such thing as clean revenge, and I think that is, like, a very important theme of this book, how revenge has a lot of collateral damage and there are serious consequences to it. And it questions whether or not, like, being a vigilante is the same as being a murderer. And I hesitate to say if Naoki and Shuya deserve the revenge that they were given. Because I don't know. It's just, like, my moral code, I guess. I believe that they should have gone to trial. And, even though the punishment may not have fit the crime, because you're told in the very beginning of the book that the age of legal responsibility is 14. And because they committed the murders when they were 13, their identities won't be revealed to the public and they won't be going to prison. They'll go to a juvenile correction facility and, you know, they will probably get off with probation or some sort of definitely not like a prison sentence, not a death sentence. And after they are rehabilitated, they're, you know, they have a fresh start. They have a blank slate because their identities were never revealed.
Yeah.
Obviously, like, they deserve punishment, but like, to go through this mental torture of whether or not they have AIDS and have their family and like other parties be affected by it. Like, I'm not so sure if that if that is exactly deserved. But then again, we're talking about revenge, and there's no clean revenge.
Well, also, like, Moriguchi isn't painted as a saint, right? She's not her husband. And even, like, the way that she... So that first chapter where she talks about her career and how she became a teacher, like, she didn't want to be a teacher. She didn't want to help students. But she was someone who, like, fell into the job and decided to do it as best as she could, right? She was very by the book. And, like, in a way, she's also kind of someone who is detached from, like, I guess what you would call normal human emotions, like, besides, like, loving her daughter and, like, her ex-husband or her ex-fiance, I guess. And, like, when you have that one thing taken away from you, she becomes, like, a mastermind of, like, okay. I mean, from her perspective, these two boys deserve to suffer for what they've done, right? Because they killed someone who was completely innocent. And so she understands enough that if she were to turn them in, they would literally get away with it, right? Like, nothing entirely bad would happen. So she decides to punish them in a way that will hurt them the most.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, her revenge was to contaminate the milks that they're drinking with the blood of her ex-fiance who had AIDS. And, you know, like, for her, it was like, the transmission rate is low, but as long as it's not zero, then I think my revenge is complete.
It wasn't.
But then
just
she finds out. But she finds out that her ex-fiance, like, thwarted her attempts, and I think her revenge was just so much worse because of that.
I mean, it wasn't just that though. It was also she knows that by calling the class out in this way, like, she will get them to bully them, right? Like, she was counting on the bullying as well. Like, that was part of her revenge strategy as well. And, like she's someone who, like, as, like, I guess, a scientist, understands systems, right, and how things work. So she was able to understand that, like, okay, even if my husband or my ex-husband or ex-fiance, I guess, thwarted her plan, that fear would still drive them to, like, become paranoid, right? And that's what happened with Naoki. And I think this is the interesting thing about his chapter is, okay, in chapter 3, which is his sister reading his mother's diary, you get the sense that, oh, he's feeling like, he's feeling immense guilt. He's feeling like, oh, he needs to stay away from his parents to, like, not get them infected. Maybe he, like, didn't mean to kill her, right? But then in the very next chapter, you find out, yeah, he intentionally totally decided to kill the little girl, like, and he's kind of a little prick. And his, like, staying away isn't because of, like, goodwill or, like, fear for his family, but it's all, like, super selfish, delusional desires, right?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that Naoki and Shuya are narcissistic. And, you know, there's something just not right. They don't feel guilt. And I don't know. I thought, like, the third chapter, from, like, Naoki's mother's perspective, I thought that was a pretty good chapter. I think that was probably, like, my second favorite, because, like, Naoki's mother, like, she's a terrible person, and she's, like, I have some serious, like, doubts about her parenting method, how she kind of smothers her child and, you know, kind of spoils him and believes that, you know, he's so nice, he can't do anything wrong. And she writes all of these letters complaining about his homeroom teacher. And, you know, she thinks that Yuko Moriguchi can't commit to being a teacher because she's a single mother. And, you know, like, she's just like, her perspective on life is just not aligns with mine. Like, it does not align with my perspective on life and my
at the
moral
same
code.
Time though, there are parents like that everywhere.
I'm not saying that this, like, is just like a Japanese thing. I'm just saying that her perspective and just like how Minato wrote her voice, it was so distinct. And like, I really liked reading her trying to justify and trying to, like, even though she's, you know, even though she has like these terrible flaws, like you can tell that she really loves her child and she is really trying to make this work. And it just keeps getting, it just keeps spiraling to a point where she decides like, hey, I'm going to murder my son. That's the only way, you know, this is going to be resolved. And I really like the way it didn't just end on that note. It ends on the sister who, you know, is reading this diary and saying like, oh yeah, my mom is messed up. Like she thinks that, you know, we're supposed to be this ideal family and put too much pressure on us. And I really like how it closed that chapter on just, you know, because you're so deep into her mindset. And then you're kind of told like, yeah, she's like an unreliable narrator. And this is a very biased point of view. And you can say that for every single chapter.
Yeah. I mean, having parents who vicariously live, like project their own failures onto their children is kind of, it's a tale as old as time, right? In any form of fiction. I mean, part of this story, like part of what made this book really interesting was like, yeah, like whenever something like this happens, like the media circus, like it's all about how could this stuff happen? Like how can kids do such horrible things? It must be the fault of like
the parents,
their parents or the teachers, or why couldn't the teachers do anything? Why didn't anyone say anything? Why didn't the students, like their classmates, say anything? And I think part of what makes this such an interesting way to tell is you get the perspectives of the parents, the teachers, the classmates, and you also like Kanae Minato also lays bare the limitations of those systems that are supposed to quote unquote prevent these things from happening, right? Teachers can't, like teachers don't have the power to really do anything. The government barely, like the government barely has any power because of the lack of consequences. Parents don't see their children's objectively. Like it's a lot of like, I guess if you're trying to ask, and I guess like something that she might be trying to say here is at the end of the day, like these two boys are also kind of messed up themselves, right? And like, I don't know if the story explicitly states whether or not it's nature or nurture, but the way that I guess I read it is she's leaning more towards nature than anything else, right?
Yeah, I got that too. Like it's more nature than nurture, because you find out like later that like in the very final chapter, she's berating Shuya. And she's saying like how her ex-fiance Sakura Nomi, you know, he had a similar situation to Shuya, and you know, he didn't grow up with a moral code that most children are taught from their parents, and he still ended up being the saint, this teacher who wanted to make other people's lives better. Whereas Shuya went in the complete opposite direction. So it's her saying like, you know, like, I don't think it's in you to be rehabilitated. Like, I don't think you have that ability. I don't think you have the goodness in you to make that transformation. So I think it's definitely more nature than nurture, but she definitely muddies the water enough for the readers to like take time to really think about it.
I thought her final revenge against Shuya was maybe a little messed up, but at the same time, it does fit. I mean,
oh man, I did not expect that. I was like, I knew she was going to come back, but I just like did not expect a bomb being planted and detonated somewhere else. And wow.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, like we've mentioned before that Moriguchi's character is not 100% sympathetic in her own right, but this story is about her revenge against these two boys, and at the end of the day, I guess her revenge was successful because she pretty much like ruins these two boys, right? Like one is in an asylum I guess. And the other has lost his reason for living.
Yeah. I really like the passage where she said, like, the only regret that I have is Mizuki being murdered by you. But every time I feel guilty about that, I remind myself that it's not my fault because you're the one who murdered her and you're the one who murdered my child. And, you know, why should I feel guilty about that?
Yeah.
And, I mean, she's completely right. It's, you know, Shua's fault for committing those murders on his own free will. But it was like a very chilling statement. You know, because it's very detached, saying like my revenge, of course, it hurt other people, but it's not my fault.
Yeah. And I feel like, OK, like between the two boys, like Naoki was kind of more of like he was just like a meathead. Right. He was just running on straight emotion, fueled by his inferiority complex, whereas Shuya was just, I mean, he's portrayed as like, would you say like a sociopath or a psychopath? Sociopath is more like it, right? Like someone who like has like zero empathy for anything else besides like.
Wouldn't that be a psychopath though? Sociopath is someone who can blend in completely with like the crowd and can be charming, but I don't know. He can be a mix of both. Like
I feel like he my was definition though. Of like, him he was able is... to like. He was able to charm the scientific community with his death pouch.
Yeah, I guess so. So he's a sociopath. I think he's definitely narcissistic.
Yeah.
And, you know, like a psychopath as well. You know, I feel he doesn't have guilt.
And I feel like his reason, like if you were to say which of the two are more sympathetic, I think Naoki is a little bit more sympathetic, although I can't feel much sympathy for him because of like his intentional murderous actions. But like he wouldn't have been put in the situation without Shuya's like narcissism as well, right? Like, I don't know. I think whereas like the author spent some time trying to like build sympathy for Naoki before tearing it all down. Like, I don't think there was ever any sympathy for Shuya. Even when he was being bullied, I found it hard to feel sympathy for him, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it depends on the reader. I think some readers will find Naoki and Shuya's position to be sympathetic up to a certain point. Like for Naoki, like I did feel bad that he was just kind of going through this mental breakdown and was, you know, he like I thought that he was being super hygienic and trying to stay away from his family because he cares about them. And like you think that he is guilt ridden because you don't find out that he intentionally murdered Manami. Like you think that it was like an accident. He put her in the pool to make sure that there's like less suspicion.
Yeah, to cover it up.
To cover it up. So like you do get the sense of like, okay, like he murdered a child, but it was an unfortunate like byproduct of this grand plan by Shuya. So there is a bit of sympathy, but then it gets teared down in the next chapter. And I did actually really appreciate it that because, you know, it was like, because it does bring the question of like nature versus nurture. And I think, Minato did a pretty good job. I guess like kind of putting the reader through this like moral quandary of whether or not you should feel bad for a child murderer.
Yeah. I mean, throughout this entire book, my thoughts were, maybe this is just me as like a mid-30s old man now, like, man, kids are scary. I don't remember kids being this scary when I was a kid.
Kids can be really cruel. And I think that is like a big theme of like, oh, children, not all children come in like cookie cut, innocent molds, you know? Like, yeah. Every child is going to be, like, it's going to be different. They're going to need a different type of nurture. And there are just some kids that, you know, you can't rehabilitate. It's just in their nature that they're going to do bad things. In terms of, like, what will be the catalyst for it, obviously that, like, there could be blame put on certain people. Like, with Shuya's mom, I don't think, like, there was absolutely no reason for her to be abusive to him. But also, like, she's not the cause for him to be a child murderer.
Yeah, I mean, his attachment to her, like, that's the driving force of his, like, evil villain nature, right? It was, like, he wants his mom to notice him. And he'll do anything for that to happen. And, I mean, what the story was, what, like, oh, he couldn't get her attention by being smart. So he'll get her attention by being evil. So she can't help but, like, pay attention
run to him. Yeah.
Right. Like, he thought that, oh, if he committed this murder, then she'll, like, run to his side and, like, essentially he wanted her to be, like, Naoki's mom. Right. Like, in a sense, it's, I guess, ironic that he desired the coddling, like, meddlesomeness of what Naoki had. And it would have been, like, not funny, that's not the right word, but it would have been interesting to see if he had come into contact with Naoki's mom, what his reactions would be, right? Because, like, he would probably feel intense jealousy that Naoki, this idiot that he looks down on, has, like, this mom that's totally devoted to him, right?
Yeah. In a sense, it is, like, you do have a parallel going on here with Naoki's mother putting her son on a pedestal, and then you have Shuya who puts his mother on a pedestal, saying that, like, she, you know, she is a doctor, she, you know, wasn't able to achieve her dreams because of me, and now that she, you know, is divorced, she can, and you know, like, she loves me, I'm her only, like, one and only child, like, you know, like, he puts her on a pedestal, and then he finds out that, you know, she got remarried and had another kid, and she was very selfish.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, I don't think her abuse and her abandonment is enough justification for him to become a murderer. But it was a catalyst.
Also, where are all the dads in the story? Right.
I think, yeah, that's the thing. Like, I've read a couple of like Goodreads reviews, and some people have mentioned, like, is this a Japanese thing with the dad being not present? Like, is it a Japanese thing for teachers to be held to a much stricter standard and single mothers not being treated properly? And, you know, all of those things are present in like the West as well. But yeah. I think like the level of prejudice might be more intense in Japan.
I mean, it's a Japanese, like, anime trope that, like, parents don't exist in, like, teen stories, right? I feel like Moriguchi makes a comment in her monologue in the first chapter, saying that, like, the expectations placed on teachers by students have been warped by media because of, like, all this, you know, there's a lot of, you know, stories like mangas, light novels, anime that portrays relationship, close relationships between students and teachers, where the teacher would, like, spend time to go and solve the personal problems of each one of their students, kind of like maybe like GTO or whatever, right? And that's unrealistic because there's no way a teacher could possibly take care of all of their students and do their jobs. And add that to the fact that, like, yeah, like, a female teacher meeting a male student in, like, private is, like, recipe for disaster, right? And vice versa. And so there's this expectation that what a teacher should be based on media consumption and, like, the reality of what a teacher is supposed to be doing, that there's a disconnect, but that disconnect creates friction, right? Part of Naoki's trauma, I guess if you can call it, is, like, the fact that he thinks that his teacher cares more about her own daughter than him, which, like, duh. That should be the case, right? And also, like, And also, like, that's ignorant of, like, the policy that, like, male teachers can't, like, female teachers can't meet with male students privately in public because of what happened before, right? Things that happened before.
I was surprised by, like, when Moriguchi said that she would get text messages from her students and they would say, like, I want to die and, like, no one loves me and, like, send these really personal text messages. And I thought it was kind of strange that her students had her cell phone number and that they were able to send these text messages, because I don't think American teachers would have their, like, would be giving out their contact information like that. Their email, they'll probably get, like, stuff like that. But in terms of, like, calling up a teacher and asking them to meet them at night, I'm kind of skeptical about that.
I mean, if you have their email, then you have their phone, right? And
I don't think so.
Sometimes, like, with club members too. Well, I mean, if you have their email, that means you can reach them on their phone because their phone can check email.
Yeah, but it's not the same as, like, texting them or calling them up. I feel like with email, like, there's with an email, there's this expectation of, like, oh, they'll get to it when they get to it. Like, they don't have to answer back immediately.
Not if you're a needy teen.
I mean, I guess, but in terms
at the same time, like, I think even in high school, I remember sometimes I would have the home numbers of some of my teachers, especially if they're my club advisors, because we had to reach them for, like, urgent things.
Oh my God.
I mean, and you also have those teachers that are overly familiar with their students. Like, going back to Mr. Werther, who, like, I think is someone who bought into, like, the media portrayal of, like, a teacher being best friends with his students, and totally messing it up, right? Like, that guy was, like, also
he was completely
narcissistic, right?
Yeah. Like, he didn't really care about his students. He cared more about his image.
Yeah, and he wanted to be a cool teacher.
Yeah, he wanted to be the cool teacher. He wanted, you know, like, when he's shouting outside saying, it's okay, like, I stopped the bullies and, you know, it's safe for you to come back to school. It's
total,
like, you didn't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, that was a total anime teacher move, right? That's something you would see in, like, that's something you would see on an anime that someone would do, right?
I mean, it's something someone would do in real life, too. Like, I don't think it's strictly something that you'll see in media. But in terms of, like, this book was a Japanese novel. It's meant for a Japanese audience. And you're expected to kind of know just how the education system is, and I guess, like, the prejudice towards single mothers and gender roles. Because, like, I read a lot of good reviews where people were like, how come the dad is not there? Like, it doesn't make sense that he didn't know what was going on in his own house. And just, you know, like, he, like, there's just, like, no way he would just not be in the house. And I guess, like, this is the same in America, because we, you know, we do overwork, and parents, you know, they try to provide for their kids, and, you know, they're not as home as much. But in Japan, I think Japanese men, like, they tend to work longer hours.
I mean, just Japanese work culture in general is, like, one that, like, takes pride in working overtime or working late, right? Like, even Japanese schooling, like, cram school, right? Like, that's a concept that doesn't exist in the States, but it's super common in, you know, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, China, like, going to school after school and staying there till, like, 10, 11 p.m., right?
Yeah, I mean, as someone who went to cram schools in America, I can... it exists here, but it's definitely, like, within the Asian community here.
Yeah.
And then, like, in terms of, like, gender roles, like, you get that sense from Naoki's mother. She's like, oh, an ideal Japanese house is the man goes to work and he only has to worry about work and providing for the family, whereas everything else is on the wife, on the mother, to take care of the children, take care of the house, take care of like bills and whatnot. And a lot of American families, they do have that ideal household belief, but I think it is like more of a Japanese thing culturally.
Yeah, I mean, the image of the nuclear family is like what the poster child of like American values, even though in practice it doesn't really, unless you're like rich upper middle class or like upper class, like it doesn't necessarily work that way. I feel like, I mean, part of it is also like if you're like another aspect of like, you know, this book being like for Japanese audiences is like this fascination with child murders, right? Because Japan is statistically one of the safest countries in the entire world, right? I think they're the lowest per capita for murders, I want to say. Like, if not the lowest, like one of the lowest. And like, but I think Moriguchi also mentions this in her monologue, is like a lot of the high profile murders happens involving middle school children because of the age of responsibility thing, right?
Yeah. I remember it being a lot higher. The age of responsibility was, I think, 16.
Mm.
And then they dropped it to 14.
Because so many kids were making murders?
Because there were like so many disturbing crimes, and there was just like a question of like how do you punish these children who technically are still developing their brains, and there is room for rehabilitation, and like should they be tried as adults? I mean, death penalty is still a thing in Japan, I believe. So yeah, there's a question of that. Are you willing to condemn a child to a death sentence? But you know, like America has a lot of child murders too. I remember there was like a really famous one back in the 80s. And I think the murderer, she was like a 12-year-old girl who like murdered her her neighbor, I believe. But like because she was so young, her identity was not released to the public when she reached majority age. She changed her name, and you know, she was anonymous for a while until someone made the effort to hunt her down and leak out her private information.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there were a lot of think pieces saying like, oh, was that right? Like, you know, she went to a juvenile facility, she served her time, and you know, now she has a family of her own. Was it right for someone to leak out her information and label her as a murderer? And I don't know, like, that is something that I don't think human beings can judge. I think there's like a very famous quote from this book. I put it on Books and Boba's Instagram, so let me pull it up right here. So there is a quote from Mizuki, and she says, "I think we regular people may have forgotten a basic truth. We don't really have the right to judge anyone else." And I think that is very true. In terms of like whether or not it's right to condemn children for murders and whether or not they deserve a second chance or whatnot. It's
yeah. I mean, I yeah, feel
I
like
don't, she, I don't think it's a thing that humans will ever get right.
I mean, I think in context that quote was in regards to the bullying that's happening was in regards to the bullying that's happening, right? And I think that's something that, like, the second chapter, right, the martyr focuses on is, like, the bullying that happens after Moriguchi resigns as teacher, and the fact that, like, there is also this mob mentality that punishing someone feels good. And if you can do it while being justified, people will take that chance, right? Like, I think there's this innate nature that people feel that, like, okay, as long as I'm punishing a bad person, I can do whatever I want and it'll be right. And I think
that mindset could easily be warped. And I think Musical.ly does mention this, that, like, at first you feel good because you're punishing a bad person, but, like, if you continue, but, like, that thirst for like punishing people, it's going to intensify, and sooner or later you will punish a good person.
I think, yeah, I mean, she mentions that, like, yeah, like, feeling superior feels good, right? And I mean, that's at its core kind of what happens to both Naoki and Shuya that drives them to, like, murder, is this feeling of, I want to feel superior to someone, and I'm willing to do anything to feel that way. And I guess in that way, like, yeah, like, maybe it is nature in the end, right? Like, Shuya and Naoki are just two extremes of, like, what human nature can become. The nurture part definitely exasperates it, but it doesn't cause it. Like, people in general want to feel, like, people feel good when they feel superior. I mean, isn't that just the history of the world, is, like, people imposing their superiority over people that they think are weaker than them?
Yeah, I think that is, like, a pretty strong theme throughout this book, about, like, superiority and, like, nature versus nurture, and, like, whether or not, like, human beings have the right to judge other human beings, because we do have the superiority complex. Whereas, like, with justice, you're supposed to be unbiased, but how can you be unbiased when you're human? Lots of deep questions to ask oneself when you're reading a very short novel. That's why I was very impressed, because you have five perspectives, I guess six if you count Naoki's sister. And I think for a book where you know how the murder happened and know the murderers and pretty much, like, know the revenge plan for the most part, there were just so many details that I did not expect, and it really posed a lot of important questions, and I was overall really impressed by the book.
Yeah. yeah, it was definitely not a light read despite the length. A lot of very dark scenes and very dark concepts. But I did appreciate that by the end of the book, Moriguchi's revenge was complete. And in a way, I think it told a complete story about, you know, it told a complete story, which I appreciated.
I read Penance, and while I did not like it as much as Confessions, I do recommend reading it if you did like this book, because it does, like, impose a lot of the same similar questions, depending on, like, similar questions about revenge and atonement, because actually the second book is more about atonement, and you wonder, like, who is actually to blame, and whether it's okay to blame children for something that they didn't really have control over. Whereas, like, this book is, you know, you have two child murderers, and Penance is about four girls who witness a murder, and the mother of the victim, she, like, after, like, 3 years passes and the investigation is not going anywhere, she tells the girls that she blames them, and that they have until the statute of limitations expires to find the murderer, or to atone for a murder that they didn't commit, but, you know, she feels like they're responsible for. I think it's, like, a good companion piece to Confessions.
Yeah.
And it's also very short.
Well, check that out if you have the time. If you enjoy, Yeah, well, check that out if you enjoyed Confessions and want to check out more of Kanae Minato's work. I'm kind of sad that those are the only two translated works that she has.
Yeah, she has so many books. It's kind of sad. I mean, like with like Convenience Store Women by Sayaka Murata, that was like, I think that was her debut book. I'm not sure, but I did mention in that episode that she had like 10 books out and that's the only one that's been translated. Actually, yeah. That's not true because her second translated book came out like last month.
Okay, cool. Well, on that note, I guess that'll do it. Well, I guess that's a good place to wrap up our discussion of our October 2020 book club pick. Again, the book was Confessions by Kanae Minato.
Also, thank you to everyone who commented in the Goodreads forums. Just looking through, it looks like most people enjoyed the book. And like, I'm really glad that you guys all participated. So thank you.
Yeah. Rira, what are we reading for the month of November?
We are reading Ignite the Stars by Maura Milan. It is a YA space opera. So very different from Confessions.
Excited to be going back to space. It's been a while since we went to space, right?
Yes. When was the last space opera that we read?
I think it was Empress of a Thousand Stars or... Or was it Three Body Problem?
Is Three Body Problem a space opera, though?
Technically, no. Although they do go to space in like the third book, I want to say.
Yeah, I mean, the last like space opera would be Empress of a Thousand Skies by Rhoda Beleza. Mm. I'm like looking through our picks. Yeah, we haven't really touched on like hard science fiction that's set in space.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a genre that it's not my favorite genre. So I am curious as to like how I will like Ignite the Stars, but I like challenging myself. Yeah. And I actually met Maura at a book signing and she was very nice. And I think this is her debut book. So I am excited to dig into it.
Well, you know, I love all things genre, so I'm very excited to head back.
You're very sci-fi. You're more sci-fi than I am, so I think you might like this book more than I do.
Well, looking forward to it. And yeah, that'll also do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you all so much for joining us. Hopefully, the next time we see each other, things will be a little different.
It'll be different. It's just a matter of will it be good different? Or bad different.
Be on the lookout next week for our interview with Chloe Gong, the author of These Violent Delights. We recorded this interview a couple months ago. But
it's coming... weeks ago, not months.
Time is hard. But yeah, her book, These Violent Delights, is coming out soon. So check out her interview next week. But in the meantime, stay safe, read books, and we'll see you later. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.